continue where we left off last time. We did leave off. We are in the middle of our topic of fairness and judgment. Anyone missed the handout questions? They are in the center of the table, the same ones as last week. If I recall correctly, correct me if I'm making a mistake, we read through the psukim, right? I think that we had started Rashi's, but we didn't get very far. Okay, so that's what we'll pick up. That's what I thought. I did have an answer to Golda's question. She was questioning why in one of those Rashi's, the very first Rashi, I think, that we did, that Moshe was saying, having the student by them be deliberate in judgment, how Rashi knew that that's what it was referring to. And the short answer is that if we look at Pasuk Tazayin, verse 17, then there's just, it's very, very wordy. There's a lot of repetitious words. The words itself are repeated, but the meanings behind the words are repetitious. They're saying the same thing in many ways. I commanded the judges at this time, saying, listen, judge between a brother, between a friend, between a man, between a this. It's very repetitive. So basically, Rashi was commenting on why there are so many verses there, what each of those different verses are coming to teach us. That's the short answer. Okay, so let's continue. I want to start with Pasuk Yudzayin, the Rashi, Rashi 17, right? Does anyone have that marked down that we did that one?
Yeah. No.
No. Okay, that exactly what we're doing. Perfect. Yeah, I love when I remember things. Okay. Here we go. Okay, Pasuk 17, Rashi. Lo sakiru panim b'mitzvah. Do not show favoritism in judgment. Now, Rashi is bringing out an interesting point. What does he say? Zeha mimuneh lahoshiv hadayanim. This is referring to the person who has to appoint the judge. It's not talking to the judge himself that the person has to not show favoritism, but rather to the one appointing the judge. So lo yomar, and if you're the one who is appointing the judge, you should not say, Ish Pony, so-and-so, Mr. Smith, Na'e Ogi Bar. This guy is nice, he's strong, he has this characteristic or that one. Oshi Venu Dayan. I'll make him the judge. He's Prony Krovai. This man is my relative. Oshi Beno Dayan Ba'ir. So I'm going to make him the judge of the city. Who ain't no Baki B'dinin. But he is not an expert. He doesn't know anything about being the judge. Nimsa, we find, what's going to happen from here. Mechayev Es HaZakai. Because this person is not a Baki, he's not knowledgeable, and he's not an expert in these matters, then he'll end up making the person who's Zakai, the person who's innocent, he's going to make him guilty. And he's going to make a person who's guilty, he's going to make him innocent. And therefore, Ma'ale Ani, I, Hashem, this Rashi is quoting as if Hashem is saying, I consider it as if, Ami Sheminahu, the person that anointed him, Ki'ilu Hikir Panim Badin, as if he showed favoritism in judgment. So we see that there's a little samach, the little letter samach here within the Rashi is telling us that we have a little footnote, that we have to go see the commentary on Rashi, which is alongside in the Mikros Gedolos, in a Chumash that has more than Rashi, has many, many different commentaries, a collection of commentaries, the other commentaries on the same page. And the Siftei Chacham is explaining that, how do we know that we're talking about the person who's appointing the judges and not the judges themselves? And that's because there already is that mitzvah. There already is a mitzvah somewhere else in the Torah which is talking to a judge that they cannot show favoritism. So there has to be some kind of a difference between the verse over there and the verse over here. So the verse over here is referring to the one appointing the judge can't show favoritism. And then once the person is a judge, there's a commandment for him later on that he is also not allowed to show favoritism. We continue. Kakaton kagadol tishma'on. The small like the great, you should listen to. And Rashi here, we're going to see that there is actually a few explanations to what that means. Are we missing something? So he's going to give actually three explanations as what does that mean? The young, the old, the great, the small, young in what, old in what, great or small in which area. So here's the first one. Number one. Sheyehei chaviv alecha, din shel pruta, kedin shel meyamana. That if you have a court case in front of you, you are the judge, and you have on your case that's worth a lot of money, or a person who has an issue worth lesser amounts of money, an insignificant amount. And if these two people come and approach you for a judgment, don't push away the one for the lesser amount to save him for the end of the day because he's not important. Take them in the order in which they are received. They're all equal. They all have to get fair treatment. It doesn't matter the value of what it is they're coming to you about. Number two, davar acher, a second possible answer. Kakaton kagadol kishma'un. Again, he's repeating the words of the pasuk and explaining what they mean according to the second commentary. Kitargumo, like his commentary. Whenever Rashi says kitargumo, like his commentary, he's referring to onklus. Onklus is the Aramaic translation of the Chumash, and it is something that it's actually a mitzvah to read the parsha, Esayim Mikra and Echa Targum, to read the parsha of the week twice with the explanation once. And what many people will do is that each day of the week they'll read the parsha divided into seven portions. So each day of the week they'll read that portion of the day, Sunday, two times, and then the onklus on the side, the commentary another. Rashi also counts as Targum, as a commentary on it. And I remember there was a time when my husband was very careful. He wanted to do this, and he wanted to make sure that he would finish in time for Simchas Torah. I never liked the final week leading up to Simchas Torah, like, you know, catching it all up in there. But it's quite the endeavor for those that really managed to keep it up. It's great. Okay. So what does he say? Shelo Tomar, you are the judge. Don't say, Ze Anihu, this guy over here is a poor guy. Ve'chaveiro Asir. And the guy that he's coming to the case with is rich. The mitzvah, the part is so. The rich man has a mitzvah he is commanded to support and to give tzedakah and to help finance the poor guy. Azake and Ta'ani. I know what I'll do. I'll make the poor guy win. I'll make the poor guy that the case is turned on his favor. Benimsa, and by doing that, Ms. Parnes Benikios, he will be financed shame free. Right? He's getting some kind of a handout, but it's not a handout. He's not feeling like it's a handout because he went to court and he, quote unquote, justly won the money. But he didn't. That's kakaton kagadol. A rich person and a poor person have to be equal in the state of the law. Don't distort the judgment even to the benefit of the poor guy. If the poor guy doesn't deserve it and you want him to have some kind of tzedakah and get money with, you know, you want him to get like a money in an honorable and a respected way, that's not the way to do it. On the other hand, same words that we're explaining, you can say, Shelo Tomar, don't say, Hey, ach ani pogim kivodo shel ashir zeh bishvil dinar. You have the rich guy, he's in front of you. And he deserves to lose the case. However, it's going to be a big embarrassment to him. How can I cause him to lose the case over a few dollars? That's really going to be a letdown. That's really not okay. It's just a few dollars. As a candle option, I'll make him win the case. I'll play the trial in his favor because they don't say my hood. And once he goes outside, he leaves the court case, Omer lo, pay lo, shata chayav lo. And then I'll run outside after, I'll catch up with him and say, listen, you really do owe him. Just give him the money, pay up. I didn't want to do it in court. I didn't want to do it and make you look or step on your honor or disrespect you in any way. So that those are not allowed. Like, we're not trying to do a favor to somebody and distort it. Truth is truth. It can't be distorted to the benefit of anybody for any reason, even though these might sound like good reasons. His intentions are good. He's not, you know, he's doing it for the help of the poor guy. The poor guy will win. He'll have $100, whatever it is. No. Kakazon, kakazon, tishma'un. Whatever the value of the money is, whatever the value of the people are, they all have to be equal in front of the law. No showing any bending or leaning to either side. Lo saguru mitnei ish. Do not fear any man. Lo tiru, do not be afraid. Dabar acher, lo saguru, lo tachmis devarecha mipnei ish. So we shouldn't fear a person, but it also is saying that in the fear of a person that a judge might have, if there's somebody who comes to him, and he might be afraid of the person who comes to him, that if I make him guilty and I show the court and I put the court against him, then he might start up with me, and I'm afraid for my own life, so I'll just make him innocent and save my own skin. You can't do that. But it also means don't hold on to your word, to let your word, because of fear for any person, because of what the other person might say. And Rashi brings another proof of another word of collecting, of saving or hoarding, like one would do in the harvest time when you go and you collect and you hoard and you hold on to something. He says, don't hold on to your word because of fear. We're not worried about hurting someone's feelings, and you shouldn't worry about you yourself being hurt. You have to do what's right because it's the right thing. He has to stick to business and be very businesslike, right? We're not worried about him insulting him. I guess that would probably be something to, you know, that might come up later where you have to be careful what you say. You're not going to defame somebody, respecting every person, you know, great and small. But in terms of maybe that would be for after, like what he's allowed to say after, he probably wouldn't be allowed to say anything. But that would be not only that he would be defaming him, but we'd like to, you know, like it would be, I just, like there's a lot of things that would, right? That Moshe is saying, about those specific words, And then I'd like to give you a commentary from the book that we discussed the other time, Ethics from Sinai about that by Eunice. We'll discuss something about there. And then I guess we'll kind of tie that together with a cute story and then shift it over to how Ken Spiro, his approach to judgment and justice in the world. So, Hevum Mesunim Vazim be deliberate in judgment. The Bar Tanura, who is a commentary on the Pirkei Avos, he tells us that if a case comes before the judge once, twice, three times, four times, be deliberate. Don't put it off to the side, or don't just shoot off an answer because you think you've done this before, and that you've done this case so many times, you've had this situation numerous times, then you don't have to think about it, you don't have to process it. He says, Tegu Mishunim Vazin, be deliberate in your judgment. If it's the first time you heard it, you would do the research, you would look it up, you would ask the right questions. Do the same thing if you have the same case 2, 3, 4, 180 times. That's one comment. Another one is that we're going to see from the word Mishunim Vazin, from that Hebrew word, what else could that be referring to? What other shoresh, what other root could it be hinting at? And the Ritva tells us that Mishunim has the word matana. A matana is a gift or a present. So when you appoint a judge, or when you are a judge, do not be the type of person, or do not appoint the type of person who likes presents. That could be dangerous, right? If we're telling the judge not to accept the bribe, then he has to be the kind of a person who doesn't accept gifts. He does not like matanot. He doesn't want to take anything from others because then he may be convinced to accept a bribe and that will sway the judgment. That would be inappropriate. Another one is from the word nisunim. Nisunim is to put, nasan, to give. So when you are being delivered in judgment, you should put yourself in the place of the person who is in the courtroom. So imagine yourself as you're listening to the scenario, not as the judge, but as the litigant. How would you want to be treated in that case? What information would you want the judge to ask? How would you want the judge to relate to you? Pretend, put yourself in that place. Reverse the role. And we actually see that it's happened before in Navi. A story that I can think of that comes to mind in the Navi is when David wanted to marry Bathsheba. And there was discussion on whether he had done the right thing or if he went about it correctly. And Nathan the prophet, came to him and wanted to call him on what he did. Not so much what he did, but on the way he went about doing it, which made it seem that his decision was inappropriate. But he didn't come and tell him that. He didn't come and tell him that he had done something wrong. He actually gave a scenario. He gave a scenario and said, well, David, you as the king and as the leader of the Jewish people, I have a scenario. How would you judge this case? And he made up a scenario. It was a mashal. It was just a parable. And David said his decision. He made a verdict that, based on information that he had. And then Nathan said, well, David, this is referring to you. You have to do what you said you would want to be done by others. And so forth. Yourself in the place of the person. Okay? And then also the Rabbi Jonah says that a person has to be very introspective, that if they're going to be a judge, they really have to look and research and search into the information to make sure that they can give a proper judgment. And some other laws that follow for a court or a judge tells us that when a person is being a judge, they shouldn't be overly happy or overly rejoicing and a little bit haughty or boasting that they have been appointed as a judge. I just find that to be an interesting point. That it was kind of just said that. I didn't see anything further on that. I was trying to think about, you know, what would be the meaning behind that? Like, why is a judge commanded not to be overly excited or to be super excited? Anyone help me out on that?
Being
and one thing that you want to discuss to kind of not just feel insecure or extremely like overexcited. That's what I'm thinking of. Okay? Yes, I'm wondering why it's pointed out specifically for a judge. I don't know, but I think it has a lot to do with that because, you have control. Like, don't let the power get to your head. Like, you still have to stay down there. And also, you know, from what you see, there's a big responsibility there. You know, like, it's not, you know, I don't know. Like, with all those rules and with all those laws, is it such a good thing that you got appointed as a judge? The more responsibility you have, the more tied down you are to others, like the more others are dependent on you, the more responsibility you have. It's a serious thing. You have to kind of weigh it, you know, for what it's worth.
I mean, you're saying that everything that you're saying that kind of right. Healthcare because I think it applies so much to my goal and been on an escalator, and the escalator, while it's taking us up, we're still walking up the escalator, right? It's still not going fast for us. It's supposed to make it easier for us, but we're still kind of impulsive. We want to get to the top already. So he's telling us we don't want to be impulsive. We need to take it slow without skipping any steps, no jumping, so to not only in our physical behavior, but also in our judgment and in our thought process, we should go slowly, because if we decide things too quickly, then we will be exposed. Then we will look foolish in the end, right? If we make decisions too promptly or too hastily without thinking through it, those are usually the worst decisions that we've ever made, and they come back to haunt us, right? Whether we made a fool out of ourselves or whether it proved to be a disaster for us, we need to stop and to think and to concentrate slowly, slowly before we do anything. Walk slowly, think slowly, deliberate slowly. It says also, but a separate point, aside from, you know, these two mitzvahs, how they connect. He's telling us also that a person should be deliberate in judgment. Don't rush to go to a court case. Don't rush to get the matter taken care of by a higher authority. Very often, things can be worked out with a bit of a discussion. Things can be worked out when you have an outsider, a mediator, a friend, a relative, a coworker, somebody that you can discuss the scenario with and come, put all the facts on the table, somebody who is not biased either way, and then that will be a way of preventing somebody from having to go to court. Tell us that the city of Yerushalayim was called Mishpat Tzedek Yalimba. Righteousness and justfulness slept there, lodged there. Because the judges were commanded that when it came to certain decisions, they were not allowed to render their decisions immediately. They had to wait overnight. And that's just by waiting and thinking and by deliberating and sleeping on it, it causes the decision to be less emotional and less irrational, right? Which brings us to the two marriage tips that people give that are conflicting. Don't go to sleep angry or sleep on it. So I guess you decide, right? Don't go to sleep angry, or yes, you are supposed to sleep because you're going to be too angry and overtired and you're going to crash and it's going to turn into a whole hell of a waste of the morning. So here, this is the source, I guess, for the sleep on it. I'm not rendering any decisions hastily right now. Okay. What else? We said the story about Dovin and the sheep. And again, we're talking about also that not only do the judges have to have these qualities, but also the litigants as well should also be deliberate and calm and imagine themselves in the situation that they're in. How would they want to be treated and how well their opponents would want to be treated. There's a story of Rabbi Yisrael Salanter. Yisrael Salanter was actually the founder of the Muslim movement, which we'll get to in probably next week's lesson, and why he founded it. But one of the stories was that there was a court case. He was the rabbi of the city, and there was a court case between a butcher. The butcher came to the rabbi and said, I have this issue, and the rabbi judged him that he was guilty. He lost the case, and the man walked off in a hump, but he didn't hear from him. A short time later, the same man, the same butcher, had a court case, not just about himself, but it involved a second butcher. And they brought it before Rabbi Yisrael Salanter, and Rabbi Yisrael Salanter again decided against him that he was wrong, and the other guy was owed money. Something to the effect of, something like $15, like something insignificant, something that wasn't very major at all. And this time, while the man was upset the first time, this time the man walked off in a hump. He was all angry, and he told the rabbi, you didn't judge me fairly, you have something against me, how could you do that to me? And the rabbi said, I don't understand. Last week, or the last time you were here, you were also guilty, and you didn't say anything to me. So this time you're guilty. What's the difference between this case and the last case? Why one you were didn't say anything to me, and why this time are you telling me that I corrupted the judgment and I'm not there? Because the last time I lost. That was a problem. This time I lost and somebody else won. So that's why it's so bad. Nobody won against me last time. This time somebody won against me, my honor is at stake. You know, I feel it more. It's more of a personal thing, and that I can't tell. So now to the fun story. Did I tell the story last time about my husband and okay, no. Yeah, but did I tell the end of the story that he was called down for jury duty? Okay, fine. Okay, so there's two stories, and I know I told part of it last time, but I didn't remember if I told the whole thing. Okay, so first the story about my husband. My husband, down on the sign on the basement, yes, my husband has his ordination in both being a rabbi and being a judge. He was called down to jury duty in New York City one time. And, they're sitting around and all these people that they're going to select from, and they say, okay, is there anyone here in this room who feels that for some reason or another, they would not be able to serve on the jury? My husband made this decision. And they say to him, okay, sir, what's the reason? What are you thinking? What's the problem? He says, well, I'm actually a rabbinic law student. I'm studying at the Rabbinical Seminary of America, which is the universal, or I guess legal name for Yeshiva Chabad Chaim. And I'm studying to be a Jewish judge,
and I'm not so sure I'll be able to differentiate between Jewish law and secular law.
So I said, oh, that is a problem.
Okay.
Have a good day, sir. Thanks for coming down and attending the home. My brother just told me the story recently. Seems that it happened a while ago, but he waited a while to tell me. I don't know. He said, I waited to tell you because I didn't know if you would find it funny. Meanwhile, I was laughing so hard. It was so hysterical funny. I wish he had told it to me sooner, but he said, I'm not sure when it happened if you would have found it funny. So here's the story of my brother. My brother also was called down for jury. Basically, anyone who's, you know, anyone over 18, you have to sign up to be on jury duty, and they can call you down, and, you know, sometimes you get stuck there. So he's also in the same room. They're making a selection. They're asking people, you know, they're telling everyone about the case. You know, the case involves people who were in a car accident. Is there anyone here who feels that they can't sit on the jury should we choose you? So my brother raises his hand, and they say, you know, sir, you have a reason to think about it. You know, very basic. I really, really want to help my country. I really want to serve. I want to be on the jury. I want to be my citizen. But I really feel that I have something very personal that will take away from my ability to be on the jury. And they said, okay, fine. And the judges, you know, the lawyers take him to other old men. They say, well, what? You know, about a court case? You know, about a car accident? What do you think? He said, well, he doesn't know. My brother-in-law was in a car accident a couple years ago. And he's a quadriplegic now. Bye! Go home! You know, studying, you know, like the prosecutor, like his eyes lit up. You know, and the other guy is like, okay, you can go now, you know, and see that demo. I thought it was funny, you know, I had to laugh at these things. Like, well, I guess you're in a better place than I thought you were, maybe at the time when it happened, you weren't in such a place. But he was like, you know, just like imagining the look on these lawyers' faces of like, oh my gosh, you know, like, we need him, I'm like, get this guy out of here, you know, like the two lawyers confronting each other. So, yeah, that's my jury duty story. Mine was, I have one that's pretty dumb, pretty minor. I was called down for jury duty when Ellie Sedgwick was a baby. She was barely a year old. And I called them up. I said, I don't understand. I thought women with children are exempt from jury duty. They said, what are you talking about? I said, I thought that women who have young children at home that they need to take care of. My daughter is about a year old. I thought, I'm exempt. What are you talking about, ladies? Just show up. I showed up. And I said, anyone here who thinks they can't serve, I said, well, I have a one-year-old at home. What are you doing here? Don't you know women with children are exempt? yeah, I did, but the person I spoke to didn't. Okay. I'd already taken off the first time I was talking. It was actually right before we came. It was really right before we came. So we said, it was like just turning a year. Never, because I went shopping because I needed clothes to come. Okay.
Warm clothes.
It was May.
Great North.
I didn't know about that weather yet. No, it was actually May. Okay, so let's turn to Ken Sparrow. Now, Ken Sparrow is fabulous when it comes to history. It's really very interesting. They actually, he's been brought by Jeff a lot of times to Ottawa, and my husband really enjoyed it. My husband is a history buff. Usually you tell me more history, my eyes shut in like 3 seconds flat. You know, history is just not my thing. I'd rather do projects than math. I learn history. The only one time that I can think of that I actually enjoyed a history lesson was when I was in college and we had to take course. I had to take History 1 and History 2. And there was this great teacher in Thoreau College named Monty Kentower, a historian. And he lived and breathed history. It was the one and only time in my life that I enjoyed history. It rubbed off. Like, he knew what he was talking about. He made the stories come alive. And what, I can't believe that at one point in my life, I knew he was going to get a Hurley. You know, and all the Georges. You know, like, I don't know. Like, he was really, really good. He was really good. And this is like, you know, you tell me history, and I'm like, not like a line in 5 seconds flat, but I was engaged in his classes. Like, I sat there and I was following. I was like, I don't know if it was the lesson of the teacher. You know, it was a very big a learning experience over there. You know, I guess if you're really into it and you love what you do, like, I don't know. I guess anyone could catch on because, boy, I loved history for like that summer, you know? But, okay, so Ken Sparrow, he's talking about the word tzedek. Tzedek is justice.
And he counted for us. I didn't, but I guess we could take out. There's a book that's really neat. It's called the Concordia. Concordancia goes through different words of the Torah, and it will tell you all the places where it is, and then you can count them, or I guess count these, you know, Google it, how many times does the word whatever appear in the Torah. But he says that the word tzedek is written over 120 times in the Torah, and how the Torah discusses what justice is, what law is, equality within the law, and how it should be administered fairly among people. And he discusses how, I guess his main thesis has always been like the value of Judaism on the world, like what the impact, you know, Jewish religion and Jewish laws and the Torah has been in society and in the, you know, the realm of having a normal, productive, safe society. And he's telling us that in Judaism, no one is above the law. It doesn't matter if somebody is rich or it doesn't matter if somebody is poor. The king, while he might have been his royal highness, the king was actually the subject of his subjects. Like, he had to answer to them. It wasn't just that he was the monarch and he had the final say and he was the dictator. Everyone had to listen to him. In fact, all Jews were have a mitzvah to have a Torah or to partake in the writing of a sacred Torah, and a king had to have two. One that maybe they kept at home, but they always had to have a mini one that went with them everywhere to remind them of their responsibilities to Hashem and for the Jewish people. The Jewish government has several parts to it. You see on the handouts that we gave out, I Googled, a picture, what do you call those teachers, help me out here, a bar graph or some kind of graph, a flow chart. Right, that's the one, thank you. It's a flow chart of the different layers of government within Canada, for our Canadian friends, and on the other side, there's one for the U.S., our American friends, the differences in the courts. Again, this is touching on history. Please don't ask anything about it. I don't know. But I will tell you about the Jewish courts. Okay? The Jewish courts, there's the executive branch, which is the king, the melech, followed by the religious branch, which was the Kohen Gadol. The Kohen Gadol, the high priest, who served as the religious authority, and the judicial branch, which was the Sanhedrin. The Sanhedrin is equal to the Supreme Court, and it tells us that there was a legislative branch in the Jewish system because the Sanhedrin were the ones as the Supreme Court. The judicial branch that actually interpreted and applied the laws. There was a group of rabbis. The Sanhedrin is a group of 71 men who made up the Sanhedrin. There's actually, it was a Sanhedrin HaGadol and Sanhedrin HaKatan. The Sanhedrin HaGadol was the 71 member. I believe that the location was near the Beis HaMikdash. Correct me if I'm wrong. I'll have to double check that. And then there were other smaller Batedin, other smaller courts located around the country. One of the requirements, actually, of a person to be a member of the Sanhedrin was that they had to have children. That because it tells us that a parent can understand what it's like to be a child and can have compassion and mercy on people because of the compassion and mercy that they have on their children. And tells us that every offender is somebody's child. So in order to put them in that better place of understanding where the person is coming from and to have, you know, kind of pity in the right place, a person has to be capable of having that pity, that high level of pity. They had to have encyclopedic knowledge of secular and religious subjects. They needed to be fluent in all of the languages of their region, French and English. They needed to have a reputation of integrity and honesty. Okay, social status was not a requirement. It tells us actually that two of the members of the Sanhedrin, names of people that we know very well, Hillel and Shammai. Right, Hillel, with the two stories of Hillel on the roof, right, and Hillel, I get known for his patience. Shammai, known for his brevity and more direct approach. And often we see that there was machlokes, there was differences of opinions between Hillel and Shammai. Within their own lives, they were polar opposites from each other, in that Hillel was the poorest that lived, Shammai was one of the richest. So in their, you know, in their social standing, one was high, one was low, and in fact, the point is that though Hillel was the poorest of them, he was actually the one who is quoted more often, and he's the one, when it comes to halacha, and it comes to actual practice of the law, he's the one who is followed more often than Shammai. It wasn't a matter of social standing. It was a matter of their own personal, of the own personal person, of what made it. The Sanhedrin also was known to be very compassionate. There were rules set into place to enable there to be compassion. And when reading the Torah, we see that there are certain mitzvot, there are certain laws which exist, such as certain punishments. And actually, if we find out, and we did the research on the Sanhedrin, many of those punishments, while they existed within the system, for example, like capital punishment, while it existed in the system, it was rarely, if ever, carried out. Rarely, if ever. And it talks about that if a court had a capital punishment carried out in their time, they were considered to be a negligent court, because there should have been some way to prevent that from happening within all the laws and all the rules of the way the court is run. They should have been able to come up with some kind of, I'd say, a laxity or a way, not in terms of letting the person get away with it, but within the framework of the law, that nobody should really be deserving of such a serious punishment. In fact, even in the Jewish system, there's no such thing as jail, right? Jails, we all hear about, the overcrowding in jails and the dangers of someone being in jail and what people learn while they're in jail. The Jewish system does not call for jails at all, because while the person might be removed from society, they're not gaining anything, they're not learning anything, they're not going to be remediated. So instead, we have the concept of an Eved Ivri, a Jewish slave. Doesn't mean that this person has to toil day and night, but basically this person is put into a home of somebody that he now owes money to for the value of whatever they bought him for, and he owes them a service to help them in their home, and it's usually a family that can help him to get himself back on his feet, to help him to better his behavior, for him to see what a true home looks like, or what true social behavior, positive social behaviors could and should be. And there's all kinds of laws, actually, how it tells us that a person who is buying an Eved Ivri is actually acquiring a master for himself, meaning that the master was not allowed to take advantage of this person in any way. And there's all kinds of laws. If the owner had only one pillow, the pillow had to go to the Eved, to the slave. If he was accustomed to eating certain kinds of food, and the Eved would get the better food, and when he left, he had to shower him with all kinds of gifts. So it was a rehab center for all intents and purposes. It was a rehab center to teach him how to acclimate and act well in society, and it never lasted more than 6 years. At the Shemitah year, he would go free and to be able to start a new life. So if we have any questions about this, I mean, again, this is a topic that could go on and on and on in terms of judgment and court, but if anyone has a spin on it.
How long does this whole system depend on the law?
That's a good question.
Some of them have it, but this evidence continues beyond to after or even more modern.
I don't think, okay, I'm going to answer your second question first because I know the answer. Okay, the Eved Ivri, I don't think it lasted any long. As long as the Jews had their own self-rule, yeah, it's probably when it lasted. But anytime once they were under the rule of others, it probably didn't last very long about that. I'd have to double-check on the amount of years that the Sanhedrin was for. It was probably several hundred years. I don't want to say that, but again, that's a history question. I'd have to look it up. I don't know it. I don't know numbers and dates. That's fine. I'll look it up. No, I'll look it up. I just, Okay. We have 5 minutes, really, right? Do we? Is it 8:35 or 8:40? Is my watch slow? Okay. I'm afraid to start a new topic right now, just at this point. I don't like to leave things hanging too much. So next week's topic is flash mobs. Okay? So I thought that was interesting, and I'm looking forward to that. It's not as long of a one, so I'm thinking that next week we'll try to do, I'd say two or three shorter ones, because there are still some topics on our anticipated agenda that we didn't get to. I want to try to get to them next week.
Okay. Or,
You know, when you all come storming and everyone just like does their own thing at the same time. Yeah. I consider it, my own spin on things. Okay, so we'll do that. And also, I owe you an explanation as to how much each letter of Torah learning is worth. So we'll also wrap up with that for next time. And then we'll break for Shavuot and hopefully pick up again after.